Welcome to Rebel Tales. I'm your host, Dwayne Crowley. In this episode, I'm going to keep the focus on Cork and take a look at the Tourine Ambush, which was a small but a very important engagement on the road to West Cork. And then I'll talk about the life of Charlie Hurley and the impact that he had on the War of Independence in Cork. He was described by Tom Barry as one of the greatest patriot soldiers of Ireland of any generation. There was never the equal of Charlie Hurley. Even though the men of the 3rd West Cork Brigade lost many comrades in arms throughout the War of Independence, over 50, Charlie's death was one that really seemed to hit them the hardest. And that's based on all of the testimonies that I've read from survivors over the years. So to start, the Tourine Ambush is a site that you would very easily miss as you drive to West Cork. It's only a few miles before you reach Inishannon from the city side, and not to be confused by the Tourine over by Glanmire. And to give you the history book overview first, on the 22nd of October 1920, the Tourine Ambush took place on the road between Ballinhasig and Inishannon village in Cork. The volunteers ambushed two lorries of British soldiers, killing three and wounding four others. The surviving British forces surrendered, and their weapons and ammunition were seized by the volunteers. Later that night, British soldiers went on a rampage in Bandon Town. So, now to tell you what happened from the perspective of those who were there. And I'll start with Tom Barry's Guerrilla Days in Ireland. Tom's account gives some great detail, and I'll be taking from a few different sources. Tom writes, "Eventually word came that Jack Fitzgerald and Michael O'Neill had been transferred, and on the night of October 21st, the column of 32 riflemen mobilised at Dan Delaney's, Ballinfellig. One memory of that night remains very vivid. About 8 o'clock, a group of the column was chatting in a large kitchen. Leaving them, I walked towards a small room, and, leaning against the frame, looked in. Sitting on the floor, his back bent, intently putting the finishing touches to his beloved mine, was the Brigade OC, Charlie Hurley. Helping him was Paddy Crowley, Kilbritton. Over against the wall stood Sean Hales talking to his friend, Dick Barrett. Since, I have often blessed a merciful providence for refusing man the power to foresee the future, for all four of these men were to die by the bullet. Paddy Crowley and Charlie by British, Sean Hales by the IRA, and Dick Barrett by Free State bullets. At 4 in the morning of October 22nd, the flying column fell in and moved off to occupy positions at Tourine, on the main road 7.5 miles from Bandon and 12 from Cork. It arrived at about 7 a.m. at a large house owned by a Mr. Roberts, which stood about 20 yards back from the road. An advance party had already made all the occupants of the house prisoners, and as the farm workers arrived, they too were held. Mr. Roberts got permission later to remove his wife to a neighbouring house, a few hundred yards back, as she was not well, and the shock of a fight might worsen her condition. Two armed men accompanied them, and had the dual responsibility of ensuring that no person left the neighbour's house, and that the column would not be surprised from the rear. The plan of attack was outlined, and the signals explained to all. Unarmed men were to signal the approach of the lorries. Two riflemen were to cover the western flank of the column, and a similar number to cover the eastern. These were placed several hundred yards back from the main attacking party, and were 200 yards back from the road. Thus, 16 riflemen were used to protect the rear and the flanks. On occasion, there had been three lorries in the convoy, and while personally hoping for two, provision had to be made to attack a third. Five men were sent to occupy positions about 60 yards west of a point where the attack on the second lorry was to occur, to meet this conjectured eventuality. At worst, these would hold off the soldiers of a third lorry while the first two were being dealt with. Afterwards, they could be reinforced to complete their task. Those necessary arrangements disposed of 11 riflemen, leaving only 21 to attack the first two lorries, which usually carried about 30 soldiers. 9 of these 21, with Liam Deasy in charge, were placed 80 yards east of Robert's house, inside the southern ditch of the road. Halfway between these and the house, and hidden behind a laurel hedge, were Charlie Hurley and two riflemen. He was to explode the mine under the first lorry, and then his small party and the eastern section were to open a combined attack on the occupants, if such was found necessary to ensure their surrender. 60 yards west of the mine, and behind a large timber gate which opened from the farmhouse onto the road, a section of 10 riflemen was placed to attack the second lorry. They were under the direct command of the column commander. Ropes were fixed on the gate, which was to remain loosely closed until the tail of the first lorry had passed. Then the ropes were to be pulled immediately, and when the gate flew open, five men kneeling and five standing immediately behind them were to be ready to fire a volley at their target, at a distance of only 5 or 6 yards. This particular part of the plan was practiced at least a half a dozen times, so there could be no slip-ups. This section was expected to deal with the second lorry without help. By 8 a.m, all men were posted. Shortly after 9 a.m, the scouts signalled the enemy approach from Bandon. Soon the noise of the lorries was heard, and in a few minutes the first lorry passed the gate. The gates were pulled open, and the IRA were waiting with levelled rifles. Almost immediately, the second lorry appeared, and as her bonnet showed, the order to fire was given, and a 3-pound bomb made by the IRA GHQ was thrown. The bomb, which landed right in the body of the lorry, did not explode, but the volley sounded as one long, loud shot. The lorry skidded to a halt on the side of the road, 20 yards from the gate, and the soldiers leapt out, led by their officer, Captain Dickinson, and the fight was on. The enemy opened fire as they sprawled on the road facing to the gate section. Obviously, none had been killed by the first volley, though several must have been wounded. From the gateway itself, they could not be fired at, so out onto the road some of the IRA had to go. Now a few IRA were lying facing the Essex, whose shooting certainly was not good. Volley after volley was fired by the IRA party on the road, and Charlie Hurley and a few others got some shots in from the rear. Captain Dickinson was shot through the head as he was firing his revolver, and soon some more of the Essex were killed and wounded. When a shout arose as the British survivors chanted, "We surrender, we surrender," and raised their hands over their heads. Immediately, the whistle to cease fire was blown. An order was given to the eastern and western sections to remain at their positions to prevent any further forces from coming in, and all others were instructed to get out to strip the enemy of their armaments and equipment. The brigade commander came onto the road. He was disgusted at the failure of the mine and the escape of the first lorry. He had pressed the exploder handle as the front of the lorry passed over the charge, but there was no explosion. The IRA east of the mine had remained behind the ditch, waiting for the explosion before standing up to join in the attack. Unfortunately, the lorry had passed before they realised the failure of the mine. Paddy Crowley and a few others fired after the lorry and thought they might have hit a few, but there was no confirmation of the casualties. The second lorry sped on and never halted until it reached Cork Barracks. The Essex left their comrades to their fate and were guilty of shameful desertion. Had those 15 soldiers stopped their lorry 500 or 600 yards from the ambush, they could have made matters awkward by getting into a field south of the road and advancing on the column flank. They would have been met by a small flanking party, which would have been reinforced in a few minutes by our eastern section, and a little later by the remainder of the column not needed to guard the prisoners. It is more than probable that the column would have dealt quickly with them, but that does not excuse their failure to stop and help their comrades. 5 of the enemy were dead, including Captain Dickinson. 4 were wounded, and 6 unhurt except for shock. 1,400 rounds, as well as the officers' revolvers and equipment, were secured from them. Not one of the IRA were hit. The members of the column helped to make the wounded Essex comfortable and supplied bandages to the unwounded for their comrades. The dead were pulled away from the vicinity of the lorry and it was sprinkled with petrol. The unwounded Essex were then lined up and told that their ruffianism during raids, their beatings of helpless prisoners and their terrorism of the civilian population were well noted, that their torturing of prisoners, as in the case of Hales and Hart, were not forgotten. They were also reminded that, in September, they had arrested Lieutenant John Connolly Bandon, an unarmed man, and after holding him for a week in barracks, had taken him out to Bandon Park, and they had foully murdered him there. It was pointed out to them that on that day, they had been treated as soldiers, but if they continued to torture and murder, they could expect to be treated only as murderers. An Essex sergeant, who was now in charge, then thanked the IRA for their fair treatment and protested his innocence of murder and torture, stating that he would carry the message to his officers and comrades. Within 15 minutes of the opening of the attack, the column had assembled in Robert's Farmyard, and as the flames from the burning lorries leaped high, it quickly moved off. Speed was essential, as enemy forces from Bandon or Cork could reach the scene of action in 20 minutes or a half an hour. The column marched south across country to meet the Bandon River opposite Kilmacsimon Quay. A short halt was made near Chambers Cross, and it was there, when the column was about to resume its march, that Charlie Hurley spoke a few words to the men, and on behalf of the column, ceremoniously presented me with Captain Dickson's revolver and field equipment, an action typical of his generous character. Then the IRA moved off to Scough and dumped some of the captured arms, preparing them to be brought back to Crosspound at a later date by Frank Neville of Raheen, Assistant Brigade Quartermaster. On the following morning, 8 extra IRA were mobilised, armed with captured material to increase the strength of the column to 40 men. Reports came in that the Essex had been loose in gangs of about 40 the previous night, smashing up and terrorising the town of Bandon. They were led by the sergeant and a few more of the survivors of Taurine ambush who had been so profuse with their promises of good behaviour. They sought out anyone known to be connected, even remotely, with the national movement, but all these had wisely cleared out when they had heard of the Taurine fight and its results. The reports also showed that the Black and Tans had mingled with the Essex for the night's rampage. It was decided to move the column on that night to Bandon, to try and protect the citizens from a repetition of the assaults of the previous night. A parade was held, and after exercises and street fighting were carried out, the column went to Billettes to rest. At 6 p.m, they were again paraded, and detailed instructions were given on the night's task. At 6:30 p.m, the men moved to the jumping-off point, 1.5 miles south of Bandon. There the scouts were to report at 8:30 p.m. Several IRA agents reported on time. Apparently on the previous night, the Essex and the Tans, in their assaults, had not discriminated sufficiently in their victims, and British loyalists had suffered in person and property before they could make clear their hostility to the Irish Republican Army. These loyalists had complained to the British Divisional Headquarters in Cork, and on the day following the assaults, the Essex had been confined to barracks. That night, about 400 of them, in four formations, with full battle equipment, accompanied by armoured cars, were paraded through the town at 7 p.m, and kept on duty there until midnight. The higher authorities had probably ordered this as a gesture of respect for the law and as a token of punishment for the whole garrison. It was also a clever move to try and convey that the Black and Tans, and not the regular army, were responsible for the night's hooliganism. So that was Tom Barry's account. And if you're driving past on that road when you're passing Taurine, that farmhouse is still there. And the big brick wall is there too. And that only recently got a plaque, by the way. So well done to whoever was responsible for getting that installed. But you could see how that gate would have provided total cover for the volunteers if it was this big long wooden gate, guaranteeing the element of surprise when the gate swung open to reveal the riflemen behind it. But there's one great story here, and it's a short one, from Liam Deasy's book, Towards Ireland Free. Now, he covers the full account too, but I'm just going to take one small section from it because it carries on the theme of the power of religious belief at the time, as well as the sacrifices that the local people were willing to make to support the volunteers. Liam wrote, "As we made ready to go to bed on that Thursday night at the home of the Murphys of Ballycorneenig, Columny, our quartermaster, Tygo Sullivan, asked the woman of the house to call us at 2:30 a.m. Charlie Hurley, Tom Barry and I could hear him making this request below in the kitchen. Next, we heard him mounting the stairs, halting for a moment and, as if by way of an afterthought, influenced no doubt by the sight of the flitch of home-cured bacon hanging from the rafters, asking Mrs. Murphy to cut a few thick rashers of bacon for our breakfast. The typically generous answer followed spontaneously. I will, of course, sir. You can have all the bacon you want. No, ma'am, said Tig, just 2 rashers for each of us. He had just reached the top of the stairs when we heard a plaintive plea from our hostess. Oh, Tig, Alana, tomorrow will be Friday. I'll give you all I have here, but I couldn't cook meat on a Friday. We went to bed, but Tig returned to the kitchen and, evidently in his own inimitable and persuasive way, convinced the good woman that the breakfast would possibly be the only meal we would have the next day, and she need have no scruples. The result was that when we were called at 2:30 a.m, there was a sizzling sound and a most fragrant aroma of frying bacon coming from the kitchen. We had an excellent breakfast that sustained us for the long, trying day that followed. To me, it's no small thing that she cooked the bacon for the volunteers anyway, because it would have gone against what was then believed by Catholics that you couldn't eat meat on Fridays. And that might seem like a small detail, but I looked into the reason why, and I found that for centuries, Catholics were bound to abstain from meat on Fridays, the day that Christ was crucified and the 5th day of creation when God made the animals. So even preparing that meat must have been a big deal for her. And that's just another small insight into the mindset of the time that our modern mindsets can sometimes overlook the importance of. Now, there have been some conflicting reports on the numbers of the British forces killed in that ambush. I think Tom and Liam refer to 5, but records show that a more accurate number is likely 2 killed outright in the ambush and 1 dying the day after of his wounds. When I looked at the British casualties at Taurine, I found the names of 3 men, and one was Lieutenant William Alfred Dixon, who had fought in France and Russia. He was 39 years old. There was also a Sergeant Thomas Arthur Bennett. He had also fought in France. And then there was Private Charles William Reed, who was only 18 years old. So that's the story of the Taurine ambush. Like I was saying, it was a small one, but it was a major one because it was an enormous win for the Flying Column. And now, speaking of the Flying Column, I want to move on to the life of Charlie Hurley, who features so heavily in most of the stories about the War of Independence of West Cork before he was killed by British forces. And I'm going to take the tribute Charlie's close friend Tom Barry wrote about him, because to me, it really captures the greatness of a life that was cut short. And again, this is included in both the Rebel Cork's fighting stories and in Tom Barry's book, Guerrilla Days in Ireland. On the 19th of March, 1921, an Irish patriot was shot to death by British soldiers in Ballinfellick, Upton, County Cork. His name was Charlie Hurley of Burleigh, Kilbritton, and he died alone, pressing the trigger of his half-empty gun, attempting to fight his way through 40 English soldiers. His name is not mentioned in any of the books written about the Anglo-Irish War. No words of his are handed down to us, no ballads, except one West Cork one, recall his name and his deeds, and shame on us, even though his lonely grave in Clugach Graveyard remains as yet unmarked by a tombstone. Yet, this volunteer commandant of the Irish Republican Army was not less great than any of our great, for in patriotism, in courage, in effort for his people's freedom, and in his ultimate sacrifice, he stands for all time with Clark, Connolly, Pierce, McCurtain, McSweeney, and all of the others who strove and died for Ireland. 58 West Cork men died of enemy bullets in the fight for the Republic, and it is no easy task to select one of their number as the subject for a tribute, which may well apply to all of them. They were all great Irishmen, but I have no doubt that, could they select one of their number as a model of all that was best in the volunteer movement, Charlie Hurley would be their unanimous selection. Owing to lack of space, this article can only be a brief sketch of a man whose work and sacrifices for Ireland would, if chronicled, fill many pages. Charlie was born in Burleigh, Kilbritton, on the 19th of March, 1892. At an early age, he went to work in a store in Bandon, and whilst there, he studied for an examination as a boy clerk. He passed and was appointed to Haulbowline. There he served from 1911 to 1915, when he was promoted to Liverpool. This promotion he refused, as its acceptance entailed conscription in the British Army, and Charlie was even then a volunteer of the Irish Army. Since his boyhood in Bandon, he had also been an active member of Sinn Féin, the Gaelic Athletic Association, and the Gaelic League, thus being grounded to the fate of Irish separatism, for which he was to work so hard and eventually to die. He returned to West Cork and started to organise the volunteers, and in early 1918, he was arrested, charged, and found guilty of possession of arms and of the plans of the British fortification in Bear Island. Sentenced to 5 years penal servitude, he served part of it in Cork and Maryborough jails, but was released with other hunger strikers under the Cat and Mouse Act towards the end of 1918. Back again in West Cork, where he was appointed brigade commandant early in 1920 on the arrest and torture of Tom Hales. This post he held until his death nearly 12 months later. Charlie was the idol of the brigade. He was loved for his patriotism, his courage, his sincerity, his generosity, good humour, and his unassuming ways. He was a natural leader with an uncommon power of inspiring men in dark and difficult days. There was a stubbornness in him on the issue of Ireland's freedom which was not based on any material factor but on a mysticism of which only one got a glimpse of rare occasions. That mysticism of the Celt made Charlie's love of country a religion, a faith which only allowed him to visualise two ends, either his country's freedom or his own death in attempting to achieve that freedom. Usually gay and of good spirits, sometimes he would brood if matters were not going well. Then one would get a glimpse of the real man. His jaw would set, his eyes shine, and his whole face light up as he would drive home the doctrine of hit back and hit harder. He had the highest and most noble combination of courage, moral courage, and courage in defeat, and courage in attack. He was generous to a fault, wholly unambitious, and, in his unassuming way, continually urged that he should be allowed to relinquish the command of the brigade and be left free for the whole time fighting with the brigade column. He had a premonition of his death, for several times he told me that he would die alone fighting against the English when none of us was near, and he died in just this way. Charlie was wounded in the nose during an attack on British military at Upton Railway Station on the 15th of February 1921. He recovered and sprained his ankle, which was not completely cured on the 18th of March, when, with Sean Buckley, a brigade staff officer, he returned from O'Mahony's Belrose at midnight to his headquarters at Ford's Ballinfellick, 4 miles away. Sean Buckley went on to O'Connell's, about a mile away across country from Ford's, where Charlie slept that night. Meanwhile, the brigade flying column had come on to Ballyhandle, near Crossbarry, where they were to fight on the following morning. The column was roused at 2 o'clock in the morning of the 19th of March, as the brigade column commander received reports of British troops advancing on them from all directions. Cork City, Ballincollig, Macroom, Bandon and Kinsale. The volunteers assembled at a pre-arranged assembly point at Crossbarry, and immediately two scouts were sent to bring Charlie and Sean Buckley straight onto the column, as they were of course in the line of the British advance. The scouts were captured by the British and the message was never delivered. And so, about half an hour before the dawn, Charlie was awakened not by his comrades, but by the noise of British soldiers battering in the front door of the house with their rifle butts. As ever thoughtful of others, he told the people of the house to remain upstairs in safety, and down the stairs he walked, clad in his shirt and trousers only, with his guns in his hands, to meet his death like the great Irishman he was. The English were in the kitchen when Charlie walked into view, firing as he rushed them. They fired and broke, leaving one dead and two wounded, so Charlie made for the back door. Out into the back he rushed, to be met immediately by a volley from a dozen rifles, and he fell dead into the farmyard with several bullets in him, chiefly through the head. About 4 miles away at Crossbarry, we were about to be engaged, we heard the volleys, and I remember remarking that Charlie was gone. Somehow, we knew that his fate was to die in such a way, and that it had come at last. Late that evening, the British nosed their way back to Crossbarry with reinforcements to collect their dead. There too were three of our dead, Jeremiah O'Leary of Lepp, Con Daly of Ballinascarty, and Peter Monaghan of Bandon. Charlie's remains were collected also, and those four volunteers were brought into Bandon military barracks. Later, Charlie's body was thrown into the workhouse morgue, where he lay until the following day, where he was taken out by subterfuge to the church at his burial at Clogoch. Owing to the war, it was not possible to have the fighting men of West Cork at a public funeral. We had to choose between giving him a public funeral or one where only armed volunteers would be present. We chose the latter, as we knew he would wish it to be so. So we marched and marched all Saturday and Sunday night, although already weary and tired after the long fight across Barry on Saturday morning, until 2 a.m. on Monday, when we arrived at Clogoch village. Armed sentries were thrown out, the priest was called, and 100 riflemen filled in the church to pray that their comrade would have eternal peace. After a short time, the column again formed up outside the church and slow marched to the graveyard with Charlie's body in their midst. I have seen many pathetic scenes in a not uneventful life, but the memory of that night's burial remains foremost. Perhaps it may be that because Charlie was my great comrade and that I loved him greatly, that the scene was seared into my memory. It is still fresh and clear. The dirge of the war pipes played by Flor Begley, the slow march of the brigade flying column, the small group of only 6 other mourners, the rain-soaked sky and earth, and the wintry moon that shone, vanished and shone again as we followed him to his grave. The grief-stricken faces of the riflemen as they gave the order for their last salute to a gallant patriot leader. "Present arms!" And the 3 volleys and the last post ringing clearly in the night air are still vivid. The final tribute in an oration by the column leader was given, and we turned from his grave and marched away to the west to cross the main Bandon Clonakilty road before the dawn broke. Someday, soon it is hoped, when the Irish people again make paramount the virtues of patriotism, courage, truth and sacrifice, then will the memory of Brigadier Charlie Hurley, patriot and leader, be suitably enshrined and handed on to the future generations as an example of all that was best in the volunteer movement of our times. This tribute cannot be closed in any more fitting manner than by a verse of a ballad written by his friend and comrade, Sean Buckley. In the lonely graveyard of Clogoch, he sleeps his last long sleep. But in our homes throughout West Cork, his memory we will keep. And teach our youth his love of truth, his scorn of wrong and fear, and teach them too to love our land, as did our Brigadier. And that was an incredible tribute to a great man. And one thing that is mentioned by Tom there is that Charlie's body was taken out by subterfuge to the church and then to his place of burial. But I want to add a little bit of detail to that, because it was really the women of Cumann na mBan who were able to secure Charlie's body for burial. Meadow wrote, "Cumann na mBan members had smuggled Charlie Hurley's body from the abandoned workhouse morgue where British soldiers had taken it. Leslie Price, Charlie's fiancée, and Bridie Crowley with colleagues drove with it through the night in a pony and trap. Sean McCarthy drove Bridget O'Mahony with some of his brain matter from the fatal scene to be buried with his remains." I know that's fairly graphic there, but I just wanted to give a nod to the sometimes forgotten heroes of this war, which were the women of the Cumann na mBan. Mentioned there was Leslie Price, who Charlie was seeing at the time before his death, and she actually later went on to marry Tom Barry. And Leslie was a great Republican and humanitarian. She took an active part during the 1916 Rising, and I've got a special episode coming on her soon. But there's another example of mysticism there, where Charlie predicted the circumstances of his own death, and it's expanded a little bit more in Meadow's book, where she wrote, "Tom says Charlie foretold his own death. One day, as I was trapping him, he turned to me and said quite gravely, 'When I'm killed by them, I shall be alone. I shall die fighting them, but none of you will be with me.' And so it was." Now, when it comes to the mysticism and beliefs at the time, it's been a theme that we've carried through, but whether you believe it or not, it does add a lot of colour and makes a great story. And there's a great book actually by Dermot Begley, who was the son of the Piper of Crossbarry, Flor Begley, and that's called The Road to Crossbarry. And thanks to Irish Revolutionary Books on Instagram for helping me find a copy of this. But I'll be covering the Crossbarry ambush in a few weeks. I'll be covering the Upton ambush next week. This is sort of a build-up to it. But there's a great tribute to Charlie Hurley in it at the end of the book. But it mentions the engagements that Charlie was involved in West Cork. And it's an incredible list. He wrote, "In January 1920, Charlie was appointed Vice Commandant of the Bandon Battalion and became Commanding Officer of the Brigade in July following the arrest of Tom Hales. His first decision as Brigade OC was to form a Brigade Column which, under the leadership of Tom Barry, became the renowned West Cork Flying Column. This decision of Charlie Hurley changed the whole manner in which the struggle for independence was fought and was to prove decisive to the outcome of that struggle. As Brigade Commandant, he was in charge of the following engagement: Ahawada, the Timleague ambush; Inishannon bridge attack; Kilbritton barracks attack; the raid on the British naval stores in Castletown Bear; the raid on British patrol boat in Castletown Bear; the second attack on Howestrand Coast Guard station; Upton train ambush; the Lepp ambush. He was also in command at the attempted ambushes at Dunmanway, Carrigmore, Palisan, Kilbritton, Farnahoe, Balnadee, and in the Bandon area at Tinker's Cross, Lara, Kilpatrick, Noosestown, Mawbeg, and Mallowgaton. So very much a pivotal figure in the war in West Cork. I hope that this was a fitting tribute to an incredibly brave man. And like I was saying, next week I'll be covering the Upton ambush, and that was a terrible event that led to the loss of lives of civilians and volunteers when the ambush of a train carrying British troops went terribly wrong. And as mentioned there, Charlie was injured in this attack. And the week after that, then, I'll be looking at the Crossbarry ambush, which was an enormous engagement and an incredible victory for the volunteers from a military point of view, but also from a propaganda point of view, the way it was spun internationally and, of course, nationally. So that's it for today. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do consider leaving a rating and sharing with someone you think might enjoy it. I'll post some resources over on the Instagram page, some pictures of Taurine and some pictures of Charlie Hurley. I'll probably put those into a reel. That's over at Rebel Tales Podcast. So until next week, thank you for listening to another episode of Rebel Tales.